I'd like to introduce you to our panelists. Starting over here, this is Linda Gordon, who wrote the paper Individual and Community in History and Feminism. This is Manuela Prairie, over here. How the Mother-Daughter Relationship Influences the Method of Women's Liberation, and Vicky DeGrazio is going to help her with her English. Jessica Benjamin, starting from the left and going beyond. Barbara Ehrenreich, one of our commentators. Bonnie Johnson, who together with Camille Bristow, who's down there in the brown shirt, on the wave. Both and then we have Audre Lorde, the other commentator in the green, and down in the end, Susan McHenry, who spoke to us on Thursday evening. We are going to use the format that our sisters did this morning, since it seemed to work out rather well. So after I make some opening remarks, each person will give a statement sort of summarizing their paper or saying what it is they would like to say about it, given this point in the conference. Then the two commentators will get a chance to respond. There'll be a short discussion, and then we'll open it up to the audience. And I'd like to remind everybody that this is an extra long session. We're scheduled to go till 5 o'clock, and we hope that everybody will get a chance to say what it is they want to say or comment upon or question. For many years, I have had on the bulletin board in my room three photographs, one of Harriet Tubman, for whom I am in fact named, one of Radcliffe Hall, and the third of Simone de Beauvoir. Across the last picture is a quote which I have always attributed to her, which says, "The oppressor would not be so strong if he did not have accomplices among the oppressed themselves." For me, this panel, the last of our conference, embodies this truth, but goes one step beyond, for it says some of how we deal with our oppression in our everyday lives. Within ourselves, amongst each other as women with differences, and between us and a society that has shut us out and shut us up. I think it is most fitting that our last panel, our wrap-up session, be the personal and the political. For it was this particular insight and breakthrough that was our major contribution 10 years ago to the ongoing feminist tradition of rethinking and reshaping women's lives in the world. But we have yet to realize the synthesis of the personal and the political, and of course have yet to realize real liberation. Perhaps we have had some taste of it along the way, or glimpses of what it could be like. We have, in the last decade, raised our consciousness some, researched, analyzed, acted out and on, and struggled over many issues, ideas, interpretations, strategies, and actions that come from our condition and our experience as women. But we have yet to figure it all out. Many conflicts and contradictions remain. We offer this panel this afternoon in part as our ongoing commitment to work through some of our movement's most important questions, for they are how we are in the world, and when everything is said and done, the stakes are ourselves. Each of our panelists has put together some pieces of her life and work in an effort to both share and clarify. They present no program, for as the last few days attest, we are not there yet. But the many years of work on the part of feminist activists here and elsewhere have named some of the contours so that we do know some of what feminist politics and program must be. But whatever the platform, the process is key. It must be above all, it must include above all, a commitment to both individual and collective self-examination, free of self-righteousness and guilt, based on informed knowing, observing, and feeling. This is an extremely difficult and painful process, as many of us here can testify. There are among us veterans of the beginning of the second wave who remain slightly scarred from a time when struggles around class and also lesbianism ripped us wide apart. Perhaps we are better, and perhaps we are stronger for it. But we've a lot more work to do, not just on those two issues, but others that have been articulated in the last couple of days. But then again, feminism is really about risk. It's about putting your insides on the line. The themes addressed in the papers remain as those that I think are most important for us to struggle through to reach some place that feels good, that feels right and just. We still need to turn completely inside out the issues of women and race, of class, sexuality, dependence and autonomy, and individualism and community in order to create a genuine and inclusive feminist politics. Let this session be a part of working that all out.
The terror of change is so great. We sometimes have the illusion that if we just hang on to one another and we don't question one another and we try to be as much like one another as possible, that we will be protected from this terror. But I believe that in a certain sense, everyone has to cross the Lonesome Valley for herself, and everyone has to take the risk herself, and that it is only by beginning to be in touch with that level of personal risk and terror that each of us is able to have the kind of boldness that Charlotte talked about yesterday. And so I think that in this way we can return to the idea that the personal is political. We can return to the idea that each of us has to seek in a personal struggle with a certain kind of risk and a certain kind of terror, the strength to be part of a collectivity. And that in that case, when we do not have illusions about what others can and cannot protect us from, our collectivities will be supportive and will not be a kind of external force that people are afraid of. They will not be a group which establishes a morality that each is afraid to deviate from. So I would not wish to sound pessimistic about collectivity. I think by realizing the limitations, we can begin to find its strength. Finally, because I believe that what we are trying to do in the conference is to elucidate the direction of our politics, I would like to add something that I did not state in the paper because I feared that it too would sound a bit like a moral injunction. And that is that if we do not deal openly with the contradictions into which heterosexuality brings us, if we do not deal openly with the problems of sexuality as a whole, then without a doubt, these issues will be exploited by the right, by the people who oppose our interests and our needs. I didn't want to say that because sometimes it's a very instrumental way of justifying something that each of us needs by making it sound as though it's politically important and therefore it's all right for us to individually need it. I think that individually and as a group we deserve it and we owe it to ourselves to begin to speak about things that are sources of fear and pain.
Thank you. First of all, I apologize because of my very bad English, and I have to read something. I want to speak from my experience as a feminist in Italy. One of the most difficult problems we have to face is dependence, not also on men, but also on women, in women's groups. Normally, we would say that dependency is a result of material conditions, material quote-unquote, economic, cultural, political. We have to understand, what we have to understand is that dependency becomes codified and legitimized in all social relationships. For men in work and public life, for women especially in family. Because women in the family learn to live with dependency without, I'm sorry, without in any way grasping. That full extent of dependency, how it is the basis of love as well of depression. Working in women's groups has meant rediscovering those aspects of dependency that aren't choice but compulsive. They occur among women outside the family, among all women, I mean. We have discovered that a part of our identity, historical and present, natural, is built on this dependence. Indeed, it is the dependency, but at the present, that at the present allows us often to establish personal relationships with men as well as with women. This is the problem with which I have worked with women in Italy. The need for dependency among us, among women, the fear of being rejected or abandoned by other women. When some of us have transgressed normal role of women as mother or daughter, well, I'm sorry for my English, but and because the dependency is, as we say in Italy, the black beast of our life, I'd like to know from your experience, how you deal with the dependency of other women. In this way, we can really start to build a new theory about oppression, valid for everybody, as well. Anyway, very important for us in this moment of women.
Dialectical duality that I chose, individual and community, is closely related to, but not identical with, several other dualities between personal autonomy and commitments to other persons, between freedom and determinism, between personal change and social change. We are, and we should be, committed to these conflicting goals. The reasons that the individual-community tension seems to me dominating at this time are several. First, the change in our political situation in the last decade. the rise of a threatening right wing which offers reactionary definitions of both individualism and community at a time when a fragmenting feminism cannot respond with a strong political counterattack. Second, I see this particular tension and the failure to understand it as limiting the extent to which we contemporary feminists can use our history. Third, I think it is politically and intellectually time for us to work on a clearer vision of the new society we want to create. We have taken too much for granted and left too much unanalyzed. We need to lead the left. We cannot do this without accepting and understanding our collective membership in the left. By the left, I mean a tradition several centuries old of people struggling collectively for more freedom. To deny our membership in this tradition is to waste precious resources and to begin a political task with an arrogant naivete. We have a responsibility. We have a responsibility to study and to know the traditions of feminism and the rest of the left. We need to change the left permanently. In my review of this historical material, there was a double-sided hypothesis. One side is that we are still confronting the same unanswered questions as feminists of a century ago. The other side is to understand that we have made progress. We have begun to grasp the dimensions of the problem of thinking of a new society that provides both individual freedom and self-respect for women and forms of commitment and nurture that can create and recreate ever stronger individuals. There has already arisen, I think, in our contemporary feminism, a tendency to the development of orthodoxies, to the fear and suppression of dissent and conflict, and to the denial of differences. I think there is a tendency toward the misuse of the autobiographical and towards the refusal of objectivity. That the personal is political does not mean that everyone is like me. It does not mean that we have no responsibility to determine objective reality as something more than personal experience. In the wake of our constantly new discovering of the depth and breadth of women's victimization, there is a danger of pessimism, of the lowering of expectations, and of the loss of nerve in daring to project the possibility of eradicating our domination by its roots. I think that this tendency arises from despair and from the pain of empathy with a world of suffering, but also from the intolerance of ambivalence and complexity. There is a trap awaiting us in our efforts to avoid blaming the victim, efforts which require constant vigilance and renewal. Because of the constant onslaught of victim blaming, we can fall into the trap of an acceptance of victimization. It is, after all, only the victims who can stand up and reject victimization. Of course, we must do it collectively. But if we accept that women are completely powerless, and if we accept that women are never participants, however unintentional, in the system of male supremacy, then we are not attributing to women enough strength to be able to make the revolutionary changes that are required. That is why I thought it important to look critically at the past and present of our feminist history.
Yes, I wanted to see you there. I go? Did you see number 7?
No.
Not yet?
Not yet.
Contradict and subvert each other.
And one of the strengths of the papers we're considering is that they don't flinch before these contradictions or try to flatten them out, but give us a chance to confront them as part of actual experience. Now let me try to sort of state the problem with the terms that some of these papers use and some of the metaphors. We are pulled in two ways, at least two ways. On one hand, we're drawn to the community of women and a sort of political ideal of that community, which is a sisterhood of free women. On the other hand, we're pulled by what Jessica Benjamin calls fleshly familial ties to a community of women and men, fathers, lovers, brothers, sons, childhood friends, old neighbors, whatever. And we know that this community, includes men and women, is not just some kind of sticky swamp of imminence that women are wallowing in degradation, though there is that. The love and dependencies which tie us there are not just an expression of some sort of feminist false consciousness, and this is true not only for heterosexual women. And we know that beyond that, in a broader sense, the communities which are based on kinship and on thousand everyday interactions and shared experiences with men, women, and children are the ground out of which comes our sense of class or racial identity. Put it the other way, and so no one thinks I'm proposing a new theory of class or something like that. If I think of myself as a member of a class, as opposed to being a member of a sisterhood of women, then I must include in that same membership my own son, my brother, and so on. As Camille Bristow and Marty Johnson made very clear, you can't be in both kinds of communities. In fact, it's impossible not to be. As women in the sisterhood of women, was women in a class, women in a racial or national group, and all are real. But we don't have a feminist politics that expresses the totality of our experience as women, what Bonnie and Camille calls the both and the and. What we do have is partial feminisms, I think, which only end up doing violence to some part of ourselves. There is the radical feminism, which recognizes, not without some second thoughts and qualifications, only an allegiance to the sisterhood of women. But in doing so, and I'm talking now about the radical feminism of our generation, paradoxically breaks faith with the ideal of sisterhood. Because radical feminism, perhaps I should say, always white radical feminism, implicitly, sometimes explicitly, sets itself up as against women as mothers. As Manuel Freire says, historically, feminist emancipation has been a break with the mother. And Jessica Benjamin asks in her paper, must freedom be bought by the betrayal and denial of a mother? Now, from the perspective of that rebellious sisterhood, motherhood is a trap, the source of all our problems. Mothers themselves are disgustingly imminent. Worse still, they're complicit in patriarchy. You know, they bound our feet, repress our sexuality, force us to curl our hair, or straighten it, whatever, the long list of crimes. They betrayed us, now we're going to denounce them. Incidentally, this particular theme in feminist thought is visible from the outside, too, and I think it has something to do with the curious fact that in this country there is a largely female anti-feminist movement. As Linda Gordon says, that movement is not all right-wing manipulation. Now, the other kind of partial politics from a feminist point of view would be those kinds of leftism or nationalism which are willing to recognize the, quote, rights of women, but as Linda Gordon says, are hostile to sisterhood, and I would add, frightened of feminist utopian visions and terrified of lesbianism. The feminine ideal then becomes the woman most enmeshed in the ties of the family and kinship, the mother. So to use the metaphor which keeps coming up here, we seem to have a choice between the politics of the daughters and the politics of the mothers. As Elizabeth Janeway said in the very first panel, and maybe she meant this in a more literal way, I don't know, it may be time for a reconciliation. We need a feminism that recognizes the both and the and, the mother and the daughter in us, our collective identity as women and our ties to classes of men and women. And we need to develop in such a way that we do not, out of shame or fear, evade the contradictions or flatten them out.
And when I talk about this kind of synthesis or a next step for feminist politics, I want to make clear that I am not asking for a new theory to drop out from the sky. And I am not asking for the 347 academic synthesis of Marxism and feminism. In fact, maybe people were doing that from the sky. I'm really asking for a way of working together, a way that acknowledges our differences and our whole selves as women at the same time. Now, I want to end by raising some questions, some quite concrete, which have to do with working together and the future of feminism as a revolutionary project. First, Linda Gordon talks about the tension between individualism and collectivity and feminism. Manuel Freire talks about the internal dynamics of woman's life. If we are going to have a more open kind of politics, more accepting of the differences among women and our whole selves, can we practice a style of sisterhood which is supportive without smothering the need for individuals to take initiative and responsibility? Which is politically tough-minded without, as Jessica Benton says, terrorizing individuals with self-righteousness. A second question. Linda, at the end of your paper, this is sort of an analytical question, but I think it's important. You suggest that the sort of objective social basis for feminism or sisterhood is drawing up, at least compared to the 19th century. The women are no longer thrown together through their everyday activities in the way they once were. But I think that such a view may come from too narrow a perspective. One thing we have not talked about here is the area of work. And there you do see women being thrown together as much as ever, as at any time, perhaps more. The majority of employed women in this country are in sexually segregated jobs, and their companions are more than likely other women. In the third world, this wherever U.S. multinational corporations have penetrated, this pattern is even more striking. Just south of the border in Mexico, south of the U.S. border, there are hundreds of factories called maquiladoras, which employ 90% women. These women have been uprooted from villages, homes, families, and are an entirely new situation where they have to struggle, where they are struggling together as women. Look at the labels on their clothes. You know, what says where they came from? So, Korea, Taiwan, you know, wherever. They were made by women working with other women somewhere. If there's any place where there is an objective basis for sisterhood, it is the workplace that's being created by multinational corporations today. So let me ask everybody, how can we make our sense of sisterhood broad enough to be international in spirit? And this is a question, this one is a question which I don't think we can answer, but what relevance will our forms of feminism have to movements which are and will arise among women in the third world? Remember, as Linda said, personal may be the political, but it's not at all times the universal. Finally, maybe most important to what the kind of things we do every day, Jessica, in your paper you made a plea for tolerance. Bonnie and Camille give us examples of extreme intolerance. It's almost humorous. The socialist feminists can be identified because they wear midi skirts and halters. Lesbians have to wear blue jeans and sweatshirts or something. Linda characterizes women's communities today as, quote, often small, self-conscious, tense, and ridden with moralism and right lines. I think through all these things, we're trying to reach in the same direction here. We're trying to reach past the kind of feminism that talks about universal sisterhood, but in practice is horrified by any woman who deviates in some way, like, for example, should wear spiked heels, or black eyeliner, or enjoy roller disco, or something like that. Or, God forbid, call her women friends girls. Now, there's a lot of class bias in that snobbery and that exclusiveness, but there is also a very frightened rigidity. And so I'd like to ask, where are we going to get the strength
for tolerance, for tolerance, and for a more generous, open form of sisterhood. Howard's Jessica asks, can we become tolerant without compromising our vision? Can we be open and closely supportive to each other? Can we build networks of support and things like that that don't seem to have built into them an exclusiveness? If we can't solve these problems in this country, I am sure we will be defeated as a movement. But if we can, I think nothing can stop us.
Difference is that security which enables us
to descend into the chaos of our knowledge and return with true visions of our future, and that concomitant power to effect those changes that can bring that future into being. Difference, in other words, is that raw and powerful connection from which personal power can be formed. In the prior paper, I was conscious of an either-or model of nurturing, or the answer to dependency, that totally dismissed my knowledge as a Black lesbian. There is no examination here of any mutuality between women. In other words, the absence